This is your legal rights. This is our annual help for preparing your 2014 income tax return. My guest is David Hellman, an attorney who's a specialist in both tax law and estate planning, trust, and probate law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. He's also a certified public accountant. Pardon me, David. His office is in Marin County. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, which has 11 specialties in the law. And if you're looking for a specialist, you can go to the website, www.calbar.ca.gov. Go to the left of your screen for legal specialists. Additional funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. David, welcome back. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I know it's a terribly difficult and busy time for you, so thank you very much for your generosity of time. There was an article recently in the Chronicle about these drivers who are driving for Uber, U-B-E-R, and also L-Y-F-T, Lyft. And there's some interesting things about that I think you and I agreed we'd like to talk about. What's interesting about that, aside from driving those cars?
Well, they're new business people, and they need, like any other new business person, to be prepared to do their tax returns. So they need to keep records, and what the article pointed out is that their income was being reported to them, and at least in the case of Uber, for those that had a lot of rides, over 200, through a 1099-K. Which is a relatively new form. It's only been out there for a couple of years, and it's where credit card processors are required to report transactions, all the transactions that a person has, if they're over 200 in number and over $20,000 in volume.
Per year.
Mm-hmm. And so these forms were initially designed to deal with people that would sell a lot of items on eBay, and who may or may not have been reporting their income from that.
Mostly were not.
Probably not, yeah. And that's why they designed the form. But it's now caught these drivers, at least the way Uber is treating them, and they're getting reported with the income that way.
Essentially, then, most people who use Uber or Lyft, they're paying by their credit cards or their debit card. Is that how it's done?
Generally, yes.
I see. What about if clients are paying with cash? Is that something that they can get by without the IRS grabbing you on that one?
Well, not you. They're not supposed to.
They're not supposed to.
Now, the driver would be responsible for reporting that cash fare to Uber.
Yes.
And so then Uber would be aware of that, and it may be that that they would get a 1099 MISC miscellaneous for that income.
Mm-hmm.
But most, I think, from what the statistics were, it's virtually all of the services mm-hmm. are provided mm-hmm. through credit card.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how they end up reporting it.
As I understand this in my reading of the article, the drivers for Uber and Lyft are not employees. They're not also private contractors. Is that correct?
Well, they are independent contractors, I think, with those companies because they mm-hmm. are providing services. The companies themselves have insurance that cover them. They are providing the vehicle for which these drivers are able to get rides.
Mm-hmm.
So they're providing the service. So there is an independent contractor relationship. Now, there is a lawsuit pending where some of the drivers are trying to claim that they're actually employees and should be treated as employees, which would mean then that the companies would end up paying payroll taxes for mm-hmm. them, providing workers' comp insurance, required to provide potentially health benefits. So that...
And, of course, the companies don't want to do this.
No,
because that's right. more expense.
Much more expense to them.
What if you're self-employed? What are the things, I mean, aside from the people who are driving the cars for Uber and Lyft, what if you're self-employed? What are the things that people should be aware of?
Well, they need to be keeping track of all their relevant expenses. And the Uber drivers are in the same, or mm-hmm. Lyft drivers are in the same group. They need to be keeping track of all other expenses that they have in operating their business. And in this particular case with them, they need to be very cognizant of their automobile expenses. So they need to keep track of the mileage that they use driving for the companies that they're getting paid for, or just driving around looking for fares or going to pick up fares.
That would be legitimate mileage expense, just looking for fares.
Yes. And then also, and you're allowed when you deduct automobile expense to treat it one of two ways. One is to just take the mileage and take a per mileage write-off, and for 2014, it's 56 cents a mile.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, you can take your actual costs. So that includes the gasoline, insurance, repairs, any other maintenance costs, and depreciation on the car. You're entitled to deduct the interest separately, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that may end up being more than the 56 cents a mile. It may be less. So you end up taking whichever is greater.
And if this is your car, then you would have depreciation on that, wouldn't you?
Yes.
And you have to, how many years do you have to have to have the minimum amount of depreciation on that?
Well, it depends. It depends on the value of the car.
Ah.
The IRS has very strict regulations about that, and they consider luxury cars or cars that are costing a little over $20,000, and they're then limit
they
you.
They consider that a luxury car?
Right, they consider that a luxury car, and
oh,
then,
my
you're,
goodness.
Then you're limited to a certain number of dollars per year.
Mm-hmm.
There's a schedule, and they update that a little bit every year. It gets a little bit more with an inflation factor.
Mm-hmm.
But you're allowed that much mileage depreciation on the vehicle per year, and that gets factored into the actual cost calculation as opposed to the per mile cost.
I see.
But anybody in business should be keeping track of that too if they're using their vehicle for their business.
Let's talk about perhaps, if you would, some miscellaneous itemized deductions that people may overlook, everybody, or not everybody, but a number of people that do. Let me throw something at you. If someone is an employee, legitimate employee, and however, the employer requires that you take home some of the work and work at home, what are some of the things that perhaps employees are overlooking, and also that the employer requires that you use your car from time to time, but the employer doesn't reimburse you for perhaps your mileage expense on the car, doesn't reimburse you for the fact that you may have set up a special area in your home to do this work. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Let's talk about the home first. Essentially, it's a home office. In order to be able to deduct expenses related to the home office, it has to be used exclusively for that purpose and regularly for that purpose.
You can't use your bedroom.
Well, no, not
yeah, okay.
At least you could use part of the bedroom if it was exclusive
oh, really?
For that area.
Okay.
In other words, you could segment off part of it and you just use that for the office. So it has to be an area that's exclusively used.
During that year?
During that
year.
Okay. The employer has to require that you have a home office.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're a self-employed person and your office is at your home, it's the same circumstance, things going on.
Yeah.
And then you're entitled to deduct that square footage proportion. So if it's 100 square feet out of 1,000 square feet in the overall residence, so that's 10%. So you would be
10% of what?
Of the expenses related. So if you're renting an apartment, it would be the rent expense. It would be the utilities expense.
10%.
10%.
In your example. Yeah.
Insurance expense. Mm-hmm. So all the costs related to that.
What if you have a mortgage on your home?
So if it's your home, you could deduct 10% of the mortgage interest.
Really?
You could deduct 10% of the property taxes.
You can't deduct 10% of the mortgage principal, though.
No.
Okay.
Now, you could possibly depreciate that. But if you do depreciate it and you sell your home, then when you go to sell your home, you're really selling two different assets from the perspective of the tax authorities. You're selling your home and you're selling this office. And if you sell the office, you're going to end up either reporting capital gains on the sale of that part of the property, or you'd have to do a 1031 exchange and trade it into another piece of property when you sold the home and follow the 1031 exchange rules.
All right, it's our Call a CPA night. We have several of CPAs here. I'll let you know who they are in a few minutes. They're members of the California Society of CPAs. If you have a question for Off the Air and you'd like to talk to one of our CPAs, the number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. If you'd like to talk with David Hellman, my guest on the air, the number is 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. The CPAs will be available to you during the course of this hour until 8 p.m., and David will be with me on the air until we get finished by close to 8 p.m. And so take advantage of it. Again, call a CPA, 1-800-525-9917, and on the air, 1-415-841-4134. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. It's my pleasure to have David Hellman here. David had been incredibly generous with his time. How many years have we been doing this? 10, 12?
Something like that.
Something like 40, 50. David Hellman is a specialist in both tax law and estate planning, trust, and probate law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. He is a CPA also. His office is in Marin County. And so for any of you who might be listening to us live, please give us a call. David, let's go, if you would, with respect to, there's a form called 2106, and what is that?
Well, that is a form where you report unreimbursed business expenses by your employer. So, for instance, the home office that we were just discussing, you may use your car. And so there you would be have the same way we were talking about with the Uber and Lyft drivers. You could potentially deduct either the mileage at 56 cents a mile or the actual costs for the vehicle for the part that was used for your employer and unreimbursed.
Yes.
You may be paying dues to a chamber of commerce or paying dues to a trade association that are unreimbursed, which could be deducted there. You may have meals that you entertain clients or customers, and those aren't reimbursed, so you'd be able to deduct 50% of those costs.
50%. Why do you say 50%?
Because the rule is that you can only deduct 50% of those costs. You can't essentially deduct for yourself, but you can deduct for the person who you're taking out for lunches. And that's the theory behind it.
That's very interesting. So if let me see if I understand this. So if you are taking people out to lunch, and let's say you have three guests and yourself. That's four persons. The bill is $200. How would that work?
You get to deduct $100.
Is that right?
And you have to keep track. Now, if it's on a credit card that you pay it with, you'd have where you were and the date. But you need to keep track of those things for deductibility. They have to know the date, the place, and what you were talking about with the customers. So you need to keep track of that, so that you, if you're audited, have that information available to discuss with the auditor.
So it's always wise to make payment with a credit card.
That's a good idea. It's also good to keep a log. We talk about having a log for your automobile usage. You could use the same log or an alternate one like a calendar to keep track of your expenses for things like meals or other things that you pay out of pocket that happen from time to time that you may not keep track of. For instance, if you have a taxi cab ride, ideally you would get a cab driver, the Uber driver, the Lyft driver, whoever it is, to give you a receipt.
Yeah.
But if you forget to do that, at least write it down and write where you went from where to where and what it cost and where you were going, those kind of things.
What's the potential of someone being audited by the IRS? I mean, obviously, I would assume there's only a very, very small, probably fraction of a percent of people who are audited. What are the red flags that do this?
Well, the overall audit rate is in the 2 to 3% area. The people that are most frequently audited are the higher income people. People that show losses on Schedule C tend to be looked at a little more carefully.
Now, what kind of losses are we talking
about?
Well,
a net loss of substantial amount of money or even just a small amount of money. But if you have big income and a loss, you know, if you have a couple hundred thousand dollars of gross income on your Schedule C, but you have a net loss, then they're going to say, well, how is that?
Yeah. So, I would think so.
So that's an issue where...
Is that when you're accelerating your depreciation on your home office or something like that?
That's part of it. But there could be legitimate reasons for those kind of things happening. But those are the areas where it happens. People that have large losses through other reasons that get reported on a return, those may be audited.
What about when you talk about losses, what about excessive medical expenses that some people may have who do not have adequate insurance? Well, what's the red flag there?
Well, first of all, in order to deduct medical expenses, you have to go over the threshold. Now, for people under 65, that threshold is now 10% of your adjusted gross income. Mm. People over 65, I think there's one more year for that category, and it's 7.5%.
Uh-huh.
And then that category will also be 10%.
Oh, really?
Right. So it's going to be for everybody.
They're doing that to us oldsters, huh?
Right. Yes. Everybody's
That's not nice.
No, it isn't. But everybody's going to be treated equally there.
Oh, my. Well, okay. All right.
So the amount of your adjusted gross income, if you file a Form 1040, is the number at the bottom of the first page of that form or the top of the second page of Form 1040. So your medical expenses would have to exceed 10% of that amount mm-hmm. in order for any part of it to be deductible. Mm-hmm. It's only the excess mm-hmm. that's deductible.
So if your adjusted gross income, for example, may be $70,000, and let's say you are under 65, then you have to have...
over $7,000 of medical expenses before any of it is deductible.
Okay.
So the $7,000 just
gone.
Goes away.
It's just gone.
Right.
Yeah, and there's no way we can retrieve it and put it into something else.
Well, unless you are self-employed,
yeah.
then your medical insurance portion gets deducted on page one.
The premiums you're paying.
The premiums you're paying
yeah.
as an adjustment to gross income.
I see.
And so that comes away and actually reduces your adjusted gross income, but it is also what's called an above-the-line deduction. Mm-hmm. So you get to deduct that. And the theory for that is that businesses get to deduct the medical premiums that they pay for their employees, so they're having some form of equity for self-employed people by allowing them to take that deduction also.
What if you're someone who is an investor, whatever it may be, whether it's in stocks and bonds or maybe it's in real estate, et cetera, and there are different... either newspapers or magazines or whatever that you subscribe to or regularly purchase to help you with your business of investing. Can you talk a little bit about
right.
that?
Well, those publications, if you're buying them for that purpose of reading them for and analyzing them for the purpose of the deduction or for your investment person, then that is going to be deductible. Whatever you pay for the subscription would be deductible as a miscellaneous itemized deduction mm-hmm. on Schedule A mm-hmm. of your tax return. Schedule A is the itemized deduction schedule. Now, the miscellaneous itemized deductions, most of them have a reduction of 2% of adjusted gross income coming off the total.
Why is that?
Yeah, another leveraging.
It was just there.
it's there. It was a way for Congress to raise taxes on people saying that they're raising taxes. So they imposed a 2% reduction so that the amount that you could deduct was less.
They're scheming. They're scheming on us.
they figured ways to sort of hide things from us.
Of course. Yes. Yes. All right. Well. Okay. So, where are people dropping the ball?
Well, they're not finding, in the case of small businesses, sometimes they're missing kinds of expenses. So what I recommend to clients is keep track of everything you think may be deductible mm-hmm. and then let your tax preparer make the decision, mm-hmm. you know, but at least they have the information to work from. Similarly, with miscellaneous itemized deductions, you may not think of something. I mean, even though it's listed on Schedule A, safe deposit boxes, tax preparation.
Well, that is deductible.
Right.
Cost. Right. Yeah.
Union dues.
Yeah.
All those kinds of things are deductible, and mm-hmm. just write them down. Keep track of them.
What about the intellectual type of things where you can, on your computer, You can put in all of this stuff in the computer. The plan that you have will help you figure out what you've got. What
some kind of an accounting software that,
yes.
that might, yes. Well, that's all helpful, and
is
that's
it?
It's good because then you enter it once and it's there. You just print out a report at the end of the year, and you've got the data, and you're not struggling going through looking for things. Now,
do you feel that that's adequate for the majority of people to use, or do you feel that that is something that helps you to better organize yourselves and then give it to your tax preparer?
It actually would be adequate if you use it properly. Because
that's the big issue,
right,
though.
Properly.
Yeah.
Because the tax preparer is really only required to get a summary.
Mm-hmm.
The tax preparer is not auditing your records. Or verifying the numbers. I mean, you're supposed to give the tax preparer all of your 1099s, but if you claim that you spent $500 on telephone for your self-employed business or your unreimbursed business expense, you had cell phone costs that your employer didn't reimburse, whatever those are, you tell the tax preparer or you put it yourself into your tax software, that number. If you're audited, you have the responsibility to prove it.
We can't blame our tax preparer.
No, it's not the tax preparer's fault if you gave them the number and they put it on the return.
It's our Call a CPA night. I hope you have some questions. I hope you've been working, at least thinking about preparing your 2014 tax return. Or maybe you may have some tax returns you're still thinking about going back even beyond 2014. It's 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. We have members of the California Society of CPAs, Larry Pond, Patrick Duffy, Laura Ross, and Diane Condon here. 1-800-525-9917. No, by the way, no obligation on your part whatsoever. This is a public service. The CPAs are performing here. We have done this for many years. Take advantage of it if you have a question, concern about your taxes. If you would like to speak with my guest, David Hellman, on the air, the number is 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing our annual Helping You Prepare Your 2014 Income Tax Return. If you might have some questions that go, let's say, even beyond or backwards before 2014, I hope you will call and pose your question, make your comment, etc. My guest is David Hellman, an attorney who's a specialist in both tax law and estate planning, trusts, and probate law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. He is a CPA. His office is in Marin County, and I hope you will take advantage of the fact that he is here, we can try to be of some assistance to you. I must say at this point, it's very interesting, David. I think people are a little lackadaisical about preparing their tax returns because we're not getting any
right.
calls on the air at this
yeah.
point.
We're almost at the end of February, folks.
Yeah.
Time
yeah.
to wake up.
Yeah.
You got a month and a half.
Yeah. Time to wake up, folks. Put down the beer.
Right.
Let's get serious here.
April 15th is coming very
ooh,
quickly.
Ooh, that's a dangerous day. If someone, a lot of people, and I know I've talked to you before about this, a lot of your clients, and I think a lot of people generally, feel that they don't have to really rush and prepare everything and get it to their tax preparer at least an adequate period of time before April 15th, because they can go until, what is it, October 15th. Talk a little bit about that,
well,
would you?
You can get an automatic six-month extension to file. But it's not an automatic extension to pay. So,
oh, come on now, David. No, really?
So the government expects you to pay what you think you will owe by April 15th.
Mm-hmm.
And most tax preparers can't give you a very good estimate of what you're going to owe unless you tell them it's exactly the same as last year.
As last year, yeah.
Unless they actually do the work of preparing the return.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you make on April 15th, you make a payment of what you think you will owe and hope that it's enough.
And if it's not enough, what are the consequences?
Well, then there is a penalty for underpayment, and there's also interest.
Ah, interest on what you should have paid.
And there's also a penalty for underpaying.
What's the percentage penalty?
Percentage penalty is very close to the interest rate. So it's fairly small, but it's not huge, but it is a number.
Yeah. Well, I hope all of the listeners of Your Legal Rights are not going to put themselves in a position of having to pay a penalty.
Let's hope not.
Because we want that money to come as funding for the station.
Right.
In any event, all right. So we're going to have, I think we'll have a call from, here we go. We've got Karen. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hi, Karen.
I have two questions. I have two rental properties, and I wonder what's the best way of keeping track of receipts? Like, if I meet with an attorney, should I scribble on the meal receipt that I met with the attorney and why? And my second question is, what kind of things do people with rental properties miss in terms of deductions? Thank you.
Very good. Very good questions.
Okay.
Hopefully your attorney would have sent you or given you a bill.
Right. Well, if you do have a meal with somebody providing you with information, yes, take the receipt, make notes on it of what transpired, and then my suggestion to most clients is to keep a log. Now that log could be a calendar, and that's usually what it is. You'd have a calendar. You'd write in the calendar, I met with so-and-so on this day, talked about, you know, this rental property and how much the cost of the meal was, and then keep the receipt. So that way you've got something that's contemporaneously prepared. That's one of the requirements in the regulation, although there are exceptions if you lose your records. But generally they want contemporaneously prepared records. So that's what you would do. In terms of rental properties and things that people typically miss, what you want to, the theory is that everything you spend on that property should be deductible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you want to keep track of everything you spend. Now, sometimes people will forget that they paid a pest person to come out and treat the property or do something, or that they had a handyman come out and do a repair, or they had the neighbor kid come over and mow the grass. All those kind of things. Anything you spend on that property is deductible, so keep track of it.
And, for example, if there was, just to throw this out to you, if, for example, there was a plumbing problem and the tenant, this was an emergency situation, called the plumber to have the plumbing problem fixed and got a bill, obviously the landlord would have to either reimburse the tenant or pay that bill directly.
Right. Sometimes the tenant will take it off the rent with the landlord's permission. But one way or the other, it gets deducted.
Okay. All right. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I have, for years, I would have like a two Schedule Cs, one for a graphic arts income, graphic artist income, the other for photographer income. Last year, I had my taxes prepared, and the enterprising young man decided to combine the two. So I had questions at the time, like, I wonder if he can really do that.
Let me ask you to hold on, Steve, right now, because we're coming to the end of the statewide version of the program, and I want you to just take a pause. Don't go away. Just hold your breath, because we'll come back to you in just a minute. We've come to the end of the statewide version of the program, and what I'd like to do is invite you to call for CPA Night. It's our annual CPA Night. We do this every year, 1-800-525-9917. We have members of the California Society of CPAs, Larry Pond, Patrick Duffy, Laura Ross, Diane Condon. They're here ready, willing, and able to talk with you, 1-800-525-9917. And my guest is David Hellman. David is a certified specialist in tax law, also estate planning, trust, and probate law. He's also a CPA. His office is in Marin County. And I want you to feel comfortable to call in and speak with David, 1-415-841-4134. Again, wherever you are and are listening to this program, whether you're listening locally or on the internet at www.klw.org, those numbers work for you. For Call a CPA, 1-800-525-9917, or on the air with David Hellman and myself, 1-415-841-4134. Before we get back to Steve, if you would just continue to bear with me for a minute, I'd like to take a moment to remember a colleague of mine here at the station, someone who helped out on the production end of Your Legal Rights for several years, Hedy Jacobowitz. Hedy helped make sure that the show ran smoothly and even filled in for me as host from time to time. An extremely intelligent and talented young woman, we were shocked to learn of her untimely death on this day 10 years ago. I hope that listeners who remember Hedy Jacobowitz will take a moment to think of her today. So I wanted you to know about that. In any event, Steve, let's come back to you. Finish what you were saying, if you would, please.
I'm just wondering if the tax preparer was mistaken in combining the photography and graphic art businesses, and that since I'm doing the taxes myself this year, should I just again make separate Schedule C's?
Well, I think it doesn't really matter. The government is interested in the net amount because that's what your self-employment tax is. I think for reporting purposes, it probably is a better view for yourself to have two separate Schedule C's, because then you can tell whether you're making any money with the graphic arts business or with the photography business. And if you're not making money, maybe it's not something you should be doing. So sometimes, having separate accountings provides you with a little more information. The tax authorities may not care. Because, as I said, they're interested in the net result. Now, sometimes people will combine them because they want to hide something in one of them.
Now, you're not trying to do that, are you, Steve?
Never.
Huh?
It would be better since the loss on the photography. I've had consecutive losses to where it's going to become a hobby. I think this year. But I actually made a good chunk of money on the graphic arts. So to reduce that overall total, like, for instance, the studio rental that I was paying for 9 months of last year, it'd be nice to be able to deduct that off the overall thing. But if I'm showing a loss on the photography, I really can't even bother with the photography.
Steve, let me ask you a question. Why are you doing your own taxes this year in that for 2013 you hired someone?
Part of it is I have to determine my income, because the graphic arts income, I'm going to have to pay some kind of tax before the I'm trying to estimate my tax amount.
But why are you doing it yourself instead of having a professional help you? That's what my question is.
The guy I go to specializes in late returns.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Now, one of the points, Steve, is the determination of whether something is a hobby or not is based on whether you're trying to make a profit at it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're seriously trying to make a profit, then you should be able to deduct it. Now, the IRS has rules where they check things on hobby losses.
Yeah.
But if you're seriously there trying to make a profit and are doing things in that regard, then you should be able to continue to do that. And your tax person may have thought, well, best to sort of combine these two so that it's not so obvious that the photography may be a problem. And that could be the reason that he combined them.
Mm-hmm.
That is probably it then.
What recommendation do you have for Steve here with respect to him doing this on his own?
Well,
that concerns me because he has apparently a part of a business that's quite successful.
Yeah, I would say it makes sense to have a preparer look at the return, at least look at it if you don't want the person to fully prepare it, but maybe have them review what you did.
Okay, yeah, that's where I was leaning to begin with. So I think we'll have some good hybrid solution come out of this.
Very good, Steve. Very glad you called.
As am I. Thanks.
Okay, take care. Thanks very much. All right. Call a CPA. I can see our CPAs are holding phones to their ears. This is wonderful to see. 1-800-525-9917. And our phone number on the air, if you'd like to speak with David Hellman, is 1-415-841-4134. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, good evening.
You're on the air, John.
Yes, sir. My question concerns the... what the IRS might might charge, if anything, for a person who has not done their taxes for 4 years and is disabled, has been disabled and has not had to pay taxes for over 10 years. They always get everything back from the government.
Well, if at the end of the day you don't owe any money, I mean, there, you may not even have a filing requirement. That's sort of the first thing to look
at. I think that's his question, isn't
right?
it?
Right. So the first thing is to check whether you have a filing requirement. That depends on your marital status and age. And they have tables published for that.
On the website, the IRS
yes,
website?
Yes, right.
Okay.
Or in the booklet with the forms.
All right.
If you are required to file but end up with enough deductions, for instance, if you're disabled, you probably have a lot of medical expense that may wipe out through itemized deductions any tax liability.
Usually it has.
Okay. So in that case, then you file a return, and if you owe nothing, then the fact that it's late isn't going to cost you anything.
Okay.
If you do owe, then there is a penalty. There's late filing penalties. It's 5% a month up to 25%, and then a half a percent a year. A half a percent a month after the 5 months up to the 50%. Then there's also interest on your late payment. So it can get very expensive.
Right.
But if you don't owe any money, then just get the returns filed, and that'll end the issue if you even have the filing requirement.
Okay, yeah, I do have the filing requirement. Usually I get the $300 or $400 back that they deducted from my disability insurance.
One of the things you need to remember is that there is a statute of limitations on refunding money that has been paid in. For federal purposes, it's 3 years. It's 3 years after the due date of the return, and then you'll lose any refund that would be due you. That's an incentive if you are going to have a refund to get the returns filed as fast as you can. California, it's 4 years, but you've got to look at that statute where you may lose your refund.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
Okay, John.
Super.
Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you for
Take
your
care.
Show and for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for calling. Bye-bye. All right. This is Your Legal Rights. It's our annual Call a CPA night. I see one of our CPAs does not have the phone to her ear. That is not good. 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917 for our CPAs who are members of the California Society of CPAs, Diane Condon, Laura Ross, Patrick Duffy, and Larry Pond. Don't let them be idle. Don't let them be idle. And then David Hellman is here with me in the studio, 1-415-841-4134. And we've got Nat. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I had a follow-up question. Previous caller asked about, being a landlord, and the gentleman suggested that, if this pest man comes out, save the receipts, you hire someone to paint, save the receipts. What about if you're the landlord, and instead of hiring people to paint or do this or do that, you do it yourself? I don't suppose you can deduct that, or can you?
The only thing you can deduct there is your out-of-pocket costs. So if you bought a can of paint, paintbrush, drop cloths, whatever you bought, out-of-pocket money you can deduct. But the theory is that if you were the painter, you would be paid. So if you deemed the value of your services $500 and wanted to deduct that $500, then you should pick up the $500 as income. And that's a wash. And it's also self-employment income, so you really don't want to do that because that has a tax cost to it. Yeah. So essentially, you only want to take what you're out of pocket.
Okay. Thank you.
Does that help you, Nat?
Well, I feel it's a little unfair. It's sort of an incentive to hire people rather than to do the work yourself, isn't it?
Well, it depends on the value of your time, really. That's what it is the value of your time.
Nat, thanks for calling. Take care. Bye-bye. All right, 1-800-525-9917 for Call a CPA Night. Yes, I see there are phones to the ears of the CPAs. And we have all lines that I think are not every line is blinking here to speak with David Hellman, but that's 1-415-841-4134. One other thing I'd like to mention to you, coming up next week, Thursday, March 5th, the Law Library in San Mateo County in Redwood City is having a presentation, How to Collect on Your Judgment. That'll be Thursday, March 5th at noon. David Cook will be the presenter. He's an attorney, a longtime enforcement and collection lawyer, and the author of The Debt Collector's Handbook, which is published by the American Bar Association. Mr. Cook can show you how to find assets and where to find the treasure map. Oh, that sounds wonderful. Mr. Cook will also show how to fill out key forms and how to unlock assets through legal process. I let you know about this because I think this is a great public service that the San Mateo County Law Library is making available to you, as this is a free lecture, and the Law Library is at 710 Hamilton Street in Redwood City. That's Thursday, March 5th at noon. You can bring your bag lunch, have a nice lunch, hear something that may be helpful to you if you have a judgment. And if you want more information, call the Law Library at 650-363-4913, 650-363-4913. One of the reasons I do this is that, of course, I've been a deputy DA for San Mateo County for 30-some-odd years and have had a very close relationship to the Law Library. So I want to make sure that you are available, that this type of thing is there for you, wherever you may be. All right. Brian, welcome to the program. Brian, are you there? Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I've turned the... Yes, I've had an issue where I bought a master limited partnership and... late 2008. It's an oil pipeline kind of business. And I've been doing the tax returns myself. And I've been uncomfortable, especially last year, with how to report things. The form, I guess they're called K-1s, along with other forms, are very confusing. Is there a program, or should I just go to a CPA?
Well,
I'm wondering, now that I filed about 5 years of returns, is there, I guess we can only go back 3 years and have them review those and they correct those, but I did something wrong.
Well, if you use tax software, most of them will have input by line number, and the information that comes with either on the K-1 or a supplemental schedule would tell you the line number. Now, it is very difficult. I deal with that frequently. My recommendation is you're probably better off to go to a tax preparer and have them deal with it, because they have a much better chance of doing it right than you do, probably.
Yeah, and I guess the implications are, actually, the forms I got last year, they don't have a direct, you can't import them into TurboTax, and they don't have a direct line-to-line correspondence. It's very unclear and confusing. And what was I going to say? So it's kind of confusing that way, but should I go all the way back as far as the beginning? And if I made errors, it seems like, I guess the main thing is I lose some of the tax advantages. I guess the depreciation.
Well,
is gonna
what you might want to do is have the tax preparer look at last year's return, the 2013 return, and see whether that looks right in their estimation without actually redoing the return. And if it looks right, then probably you don't need to go back. If it looks wrong, if there's some gross error, then yes, probably it would make sense to have them go back just to check the other years too.
Okay, so I guess it's a 3-year period. So I
right.
This is basically December 2008. So I could revise 13 and 12, but 11 and 10.
Well, 11 you could. It's 3 years. You go back 3-year returns, so you'd have 13 and 12 and 11 you could potentially amend if you got that done before April 15th.
Okay,
Brian.
I guess is the main liability I'll have is basically because I didn't depreciate, I didn't get the advantage now, so when I sell it, I'm going to end up with more of a tax liability, but there won't be any penalty, I don't think.
Well, no, I mean, if you didn't take the depreciation, then you would have a higher basis, so you'd have less of a gain, although mm-hmm. the depreciation rules do say it's taken or should have been taken. So theoretically, you lose it, but typically it's not treated that way by preparers.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, Brian, thank you very much for calling. All right. are called CPAs. What am I seeing here? I think they're all on the phone. I hope they are. 1-800-525-9917. I want to thank these people who have shown up, who are members of the California Society of CPAs. They'll be here another 15 minutes. Larry Pond, Patrick Duffy, Laura Ross, and Diane Condon. So if you have a question that you'd like to spend a little time with a CPA off the air, it's 1-800-525-9917. Again, on the air with me is a great supporter of this program and a man of great generosity of his time, David Hellman, has been doing these programs with me. Essentially, we do two a year, one just a short time before April 15th, and then we do one late in the previous year, kind of giving you a hint of those things that you should be thinking about. So we do this a couple of times a year, and David's been doing this with me over 10 years. He's a specialist in both tax law and estate planning, trust and probate law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. He's also a CPA. His office is in Marin County. And let's see, I think we have Bill. Bill, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I have a question regarding a deductibility for mileage.
Go ahead.
I'm self-employed as a dog walker and pet sitter, and I keep a record in my car of my mileage for my business. And that's not just gasoline receipts, the actual mileage that I travel. And then I am also a volunteer for a nonprofit, and I keep the mileage for that also in the schedule. Anyway, when I had my taxes done 2 years ago, my tax preparer wanted to know what my personal mileage was. That is, not for the nonprofit or the business.
Just going to the market or going to the beach or something like that, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, first of all, why does the government need to know that? And second of all, am I eligible for deductibility for mileage for the other two purposes of driving?
Okay, well, the reason that they want to know your personal mileage is because they want to know, basically, you start with the total miles you drove during the year. Then you've got the business miles you used as a dog walker, and right. Presumably your office is in your home, so it would be driving from home to the location of where you picked up the dogs and
exactly.
Walked them, and then drove back home. So that's deductible. That's not a problem. And then the other thing you have is the volunteer mileage, and that is deductible as a miscellaneous itemized deduction, charitable deduction on Schedule A.
Is it the same 56 miles?
No, it's 14 cents a mile.
14 cents.
For
so if you're a volunteer,
yeah,
boy, you're paying for it. Okay.
Right. You don't get full cost.
Yeah.
But what they do is that where you report this, particularly for your home business, there is a schedule that goes with that. And the schedule asks what your total mileage was, and then what was the personal mileage, and then what is the business mileage. So that's the reason that the preparer asked. It was a valid question.
And what is the amount deductible for business mileage?
It's 56 cents for 2014.
Oh, wow. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Okay, take care. Thank you very much for calling, Bill. Edwin, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you very much. Your program is great.
Thank you.
I'm in a situation where I owned a marina in Sausalito, California. I was advised to sell most of my property to the city of Sausalito as a gesture of goodwill and as a gesture to move the project along.
Did you do that, Edwin?
Yes.
You have done that. Okay, the deal is done.
Yes.
During 2014?
No, in 2002.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Well, there were two sales, 2002 and 2003. And I 1031'd into a lease over 31 years, which was a commercial penthouse in San Francisco, fully commercial. Even though it's called a penthouse, it's just the top floor. And it had never been used. as a residential and never was. I was challenged by that, even though the IRS, I brought to the IRS, they said that's fine, that's why I went forward. The FTB challenged me on it. My CPA, a very good CPA, Susan McGuire at Chow Smith. I'm not trying to give her a plug. I'm just saying, you know, I had a good, very good CPA, and the name's probably well known, of Chow Smith. And she presented it, and it was written up in one of their of the CPA's monthly.
Well, what's the question, though? We got to keep moving, Edwin, please.
The question is that it was denied by the FTB. Then we appealed to the DOE. I hired an excellent attorney in Beverly Hills who had, I'm not sure what, but for some reason made a very, very bad presentation, and we lost there. The lease was very clear. It said the lease, you know, the terms of the lease on page 5 had stated that that this lease only comes into effect as of a date of reference. The date of reference is March 1st, 2004. which was within 180 days.
Edwin, I have to tell you, I want you to get right to the point because we're running out of time. Please.
The FTB hit me with a $400,000 and hit my corporation with a $150,000 tag. Alleged that my girlfriend was a...
Okay, but all right. What's your question? Please, quickly.
That... You're not allowed to appeal until you pay it. It's sort of like you can't appeal your conviction until you serve your sentence.
Let me get David to
respond. All right, so you're right. The state law is that the process for the Franchise Tax Board, which is very aggressive on 1031 exchanges, they're much more aggressive than the IRS. In fact, they try to audit every 1031 exchange and try to disallow them.
Wow.
They feel that about 40% of them are bad, and they try to disallow 100% if they could.
Oh boy.
But the theory is that, and the way California law works, is you're audited with an auditor. If you don't like the results there, you can go to appeals. If you don't like the results of the appeals officer, you can go to the California State Board of Equalization.
Yeah.
If you don't like that result, then you have to pay the tax, and then you file a refund suit in Superior Court. Now, that's the process in California. A lot of people don't like it. I personally don't think it's right either, but that's the way it is, and the only way to change that would be to have the state legislature change the law.
Well, wouldn't it be a lack of due process? Because the IRS allows you to challenge your taxes.
It doesn't work that way for the state, and that challenge has been made and not succeeded.
Edwin, we've got someone else who'd like to talk with David. Thank you very much for calling. Good luck. Thank you, very much. Okay. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County. For a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county, every county in California has a bar association and lawyer referral service. You can call your own. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced for your problem, set you up for half an hour consultation. With minor exception, the cost for half an hour will be somewhere between $25 to $35. That does not go to the attorney. It goes to the lawyer referral service, as it is a public service. All right. David, thank you for being patient. What is your question, please?
Yes, a simple enough one. How long does one keep records?
Oh, good question. Good question.
All right. So the federal statute of limitations is 3 years. The California one is 4. I generally would tell clients keep records other than related to real property for at least 5 years. That should cover you there, and also with any civil issues, if there's a question ever about whether you paid a bill outside of the tax law, it's just keep it at least for 5 years. For real property, you should keep the you should keep all the records related to that real property back to the purchase of the property, and then up through the sale, and then you apply the 5 years to the sale time.
When you say the 5 years, what do you mean by that?
Well, in other words, you'd keep it 5 years beyond the date of sale.
Okay, gotcha.
Now, if you did a 1031 exchange into that property, you need to keep the records for the 1031 exchange property also until you finally end up paying the tax on whatever the replacement property is, because they have a right to challenge your basis on the property that you bought through the 1031 exchange, so you have to have the records that would establish the basis on the 1031 property.
Don't shred.
No.
Don't shred anything.
Better to keep it if it relates to real property.
I want to invite you again to call CPA Night, or call a CPA Night. Our CPAs are still here. They're very gracious with their time. 1-800-525-9917. And I want to thank them again. They are members of the California Society of CPAs, Larry Pond, Patrick Duffy, Laura Ross, and Diane Condon. We have, I think, we have covered everybody who has called in to speak with you, David. We have a couple of minutes left. Do you have some final thoughts to try to cheer people up, if that's humanly possible?
Well, considering it's talking about taxes, I'm not so sure.
No, we're not going to cheer anybody up.
We're not going to cheer anybody up.
Yeah. One, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Here's a question. What about people who signed up with the Affordable Care Act? Are those medical benefits taxable? And what about people who didn't sign up with the Affordable Care Act? Do they owe a penalty to the IRS? Can you respond to that?
I can give a partial response because that's something you could talk about for hours.
Yeah.
Whether or not you have when you sign up for the Affordable Care Act and get public benefits through Covered California, you're given a credit. And your credit is based on your income. If you underestimated your income when you told Covered California about needing coverage, then they will have given you more credit than you would have been entitled to, so you will owe some of that credit back.
Mm-hmm.
If you do not have coverage at all and your income is over a certain amount, there is a penalty. It's basically if it's over the poverty amount. So you will then owe a penalty for not having insurance. Now, if you had insurance part of the time and not part of the time, then there's a very complicated calculation that you have to go through to figure out what you owe the government.
We did a program recently that included this, and unfortunately, we have run out of time. David, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Great to have you here. My guest has been David Hellman, Certified Specialist in Taxation Law, Trusts and Estate, and Probate Law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. David, thanks so much.
You're most
welcome. Great to have you here. Let me just let you know that our program engineer, Joanne Marr, and production assistant, Martin McLean. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. Additional funding for the program is provided by the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Next week, the topic will be the special education rights of special needs children required by the Individual with Disabilities in Education Act. My guest will be Mary Lynn Hansen, an attorney who represents special needs children. Thank you very much for listening to Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. Thank you.